All right, let's do this one last time. My name is Altaf Nanawadi. I was bitten by a radioactive spider, and for the last 4 years, I've been the one and only movie podcaster. I'm pretty sure you know the rest. I had a lot of hot takes about Zack Snyder's Justice League, talked about how Logan is actually a Western, and even met a cool friend named Chris along the way. Today, I'm going to be talking about Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse. Why? Because the only thing standing between podcasting and oblivion is me. This is Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse.
The first thing that comes to my mind is, how the fuck are we going to edit that?
Well, that's the thing that's funny, is now you're going to be editing.
I know, yeah.
No. Like, I had that in mind. But, yeah.
Yeah. So,
welcome to, you know, the new setup.
Yeah, that's what I was about to say, yeah. So for those who haven't heard any of our updates or any of that stuff, that we're shooting on a two camera setup and we're using different mics, so it's a little bit of a transition for us, you know.
Yeah.
And for those listening, we might sound different. Probably we do.
Hopefully it's better. But I'm really excited. We're also, like, we've also changed the name of the podcast. If you couldn't tell, if you didn't see our announcement video, it's now going to be called Movies That Changed Us.
Yeah.
And it's just, you know, we're going to stick with what the podcast has been. Nothing about it's going to change, but it's more focused on what the theme of this podcast is, which is movies that changed us, movies that bring us closer as friends. I don't know.
Reveal more about ourselves and, you know, storytelling kind of.
Thank you.
Yeah, I'm not even joking when I say this, funny enough, but I'm saying storytelling, you do learn about yourself when you experience meaningful stories in a weird way. You
know? Yeah.
I don't like saying corny shit like that, but it's true.
That's why I immediately took it as a joke.
Yeah, I know. I get it. But today we're going to be talking about Into the Spider-Verse.
Yeah, we are. These mics make everything sound and feel more professional. So it does take a second for us to break out of that.
Yeah, it gives us an NPR kind of kick.
I know. Okay. So this movie, right from like the moment I saw it in theaters, it became like an instant classic for me. I don't know if it was the same for you, but I remember there's a lot of excitement, obviously, when this movie was coming out.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. You remember that teaser trailer?
Oh, my God.
Where it was just Miles leaping off the building.
Yeah. Well, okay. So that's another thing. We saw that shot so many times in the trailers and everything, but when we saw it in theaters, it was a different experience. We'll get to that. But like, I remember the hype for this movie. Primarily because of the animation style. The animation immediately felt like fresh. It felt new. It felt like weird. And everything was just so exciting, you know?
Yeah.
Which is kind of a shock because we'd seen like so many Spider-Man movies up until then. And now, still, they keep making more. Like, there's like these great Spider-Man video games too. There's so much Spider-Man out there. But something about this movie when it was coming out was just like, oh my God, we're going to see something new. And that was because of Miles Morales as well.
Yeah, it ignited like a lot when it comes to what future Spider-Man projects became. You know what I mean? And just at the risk of spoiling any other Spider-Man stuff, you know what I'm talking about. You know, the MCU Spider-Man movies clearly took a page out of Into the Spider-Verse's book. And so did the Insomniac Spider-Man video games when it comes to their interpretation of Miles Morales. And the energy that they give it.
I have it like right here where it genuinely brought this new life to animated movies as well.
Yeah.
And I mean, Puss in Boots, Last Wish, TMNT are very recent examples of them taking a page out of this book. And I don't think that's a bad thing, but it is kind of interesting how this movie just like exploded the genre for a second. And it was like, whoa, we could do this too. This is really cool.
Yeah. And I think this is obvious, but the main thing that makes Spider-Verse in particular so effective is it clearly understood what Spider-Man is at the same time. It told an awesome story at the same time as having like breathtaking animation and having this fresh outlook on how to interpret it.
Yeah. So, okay, let's take a step back before we get into, like, what our thoughts is. Like, what does Spider-Man mean to you? Like, I think you and I, like, through these, like, 6 years of friendship have talked about this guy more than any other like,
character.
Yeah, I mean, this is, like, our dude.
Yeah, Spider-Man's my dude, you know? I fucking love Spider-Man. I'm one of those people. I grew up with the Raimi movies. I had a Spider-Man themed birthday party as a kid. May or may not have photos. I'm not 100% sure, but I did have a Spider-Man themed birthday party when I was like six, I think seven or six. And he's just always been one of my favorite fictional characters of all time. You know, I think Spider-Man in general is like, I think there's something that everyone can relate to with the character of Peter Parker.
He's the best superhero out there. Like, I genuinely think he's like the reason why I like superheroes. And I'm not a huge superhero person, but like Spider-Man to me is like the best version of it.
Yeah, yeah. I think he's most good interpretations of Spider-Man, at least, are often like kind of a demonstration of how much pain can a person go through to do the right thing.
Yeah.
You know?
And like, Raimi takes it to a certain point, Spider-Man 2, where it becomes kind of like torture porn for a second, where I'm like, literally every single thing. He goes for an hors d'oeuvre, there's no more left.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And Spider-Man 2 will always be my favorite Spider-Man movie of all time. I'm one of those basic bitches. You know?
Well, we both are. I think, like, you and I both grew up with the Raimi movies.
Yeah.
The video games, I will say, too. Like, we both played the OG, like, Spider-Man 1 and 2 games.
Oh, yeah. Did you play the PlayStation 1 Spider-Man games?
So that's where I'm not at your level. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I got you beat. I don't know what that is.
You shot me. Stop it.
But, yeah, so...
I think, like, let's stay on that for a second. Because, like... I think you and I are in the generation of the Raimi Spider-Man movies. That's kind of our Spider-Man. It's kind of like how people talk about James Bond, where it's just like, it's the James Bond that you grew up with is your James Bond.
Yeah. Yeah.
So for us, it would be Daniel Craig.
You sure. Yeah. Batman has that effect too, as well.
So like would Christian Bale would be ours.
Yeah. Christian Bale is definitely our
But then our dads would be Tim Burton.
Yeah. Yeah. Michael Keaton. You know, some people even.
Sorry. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Michael Keaton. Yeah, yeah.
I get what you're saying.
But it's kind of like that at this point because there's been so many Spider-Man stuff. There's been so many Spider-Man movies.
Yeah.
And I think it's some have fell through. Some have seen ultimate success, right? But even the Andrew Garfield ones, which I think now people are trying to reclaim because of No Way Home, I still think they have many flaws. But there's something about Spider-Man that even when I watch the worst Spider-Man movie, like let's say I think the worst Spider-Man movie to have come out is Amazing Spider-Man 2, it's still him swinging through New York. I'm still going to enjoy it. I don't know. Like there's still something about it where I'm like, I'll go see it. It's still going to be kind of enjoyable. I'm never going to come out of a Spider-Man movie and be like, what the hell did they do?
Yeah.
I've come out of Far From Home like that.
Yeah.
But even in Far From Home, the ending of Far From Home, when he's swinging through New York, I'm like, oh, you fucking assholes. You got me again.
Yeah. I think Spider-Man movies are like what they say about sex and pizza. Like even when it's bad, it's still pretty good.
Yeah. It's very true. And I think that's why Into the Spider-Verse was a huge deal.
Mm-hmm.
Because I went into that movie with a lot of excitement and I came out of it feeling like I had seen something new.
Yeah.
Which is a feeling from Spider-Man that I actually really haven't had in a while. Now, I think like, you know, the MCU Spider-Man was new in a sense of just like, oh, they got like a younger guy. They got like someone who actually passes off as a teenager and they're telling a more teenage story. So that was the new aspect. But honestly, like I didn't really connect to the Tom Holland Spider-Man as other people did. But I think the reason I connected to Into the Spider-Verse a lot was, well, first of all, I'm seeing it through a new perspective, which is Miles Morales, a black Spider-Man. Mm-hmm. So that is immediately a new perspective.
Yeah, it's just a different character than Peter Parker, which has been told time and time again.
But then I feel like this movie, and maybe we can start here, is kind of opening up the Bible of Spider-Man a little bit and is just being like, we know you've seen all the Spider-Man movies. Like, we know you're a fan. And if you're a Raimi fan, we're going to acknowledge it. We're going to show some of the shots from the Raimi movies like it does in the opening montage.
Yeah, yeah.
It literally shows a shot of him saving MJ from the car going into the cafe.
Yeah, the upside down kiss, him stopping the train, and then him dancing, obviously, like in Spider-Man 3.
Yeah, it's like, okay, we're acknowledging that.
Yeah.
We're gonna like also say all the phrases that you've heard about Spider-Man. He always gets back up. Great power comes great responsibility. But then we're also going to use those to challenge Miles, mm-hmm. to be like, there's this legacy of Spider-Man. Can you live up to it?
Yeah.
Which is such a fresh take on a Spider-Man movie of like acknowledging all that's come before and then challenging this new guy and making Spider-Man feel even more of an outsider because he doesn't even fit in within the Spider-Men.
Yeah, yeah. This is like the lesser Spider-Man.
And that's why he's immediately so winning.
Yeah, well, exactly. And Miles has kind of the telltale, like, coming of age signs.
Yeah.
You know, where he's eager. He wants to be a Spider-Man. He wants pointers. He's asking Peter, like, oh, you know, teach me how to do this. Oh, that's it? Why am I stuck with this Spider-Man? But then the minute he's actually, you know, asked to step up to the plate, he chickens out.
He can't do it.
Yeah, and that's reality. People do function that way, I think, especially when you're young.
Yeah, completely. Like, yeah. You want to strive for so much. I think the feeling I had a lot as a kid is a feeling that I'm sure many people share,
yeah.
Is that I immediately wanted to grow up, and I immediately wanted to just, like, have my own apartment, and I wanted to, like, just live on my own.
Yeah.
And it was this ultimate fantasy of just, like, I want to do everything for myself, but then not wanting to do the work or having the means to do it and constantly feeling the struggle. But that was not just because of, like, the regular kid stuff, right? Of just, like, oh, you want to grow up really fast. But also for me, I had this feeling when I was growing up that, like, it was not even like I, like, in my own high school, it felt like I wasn't smart enough to fit in with the nerds. I wasn't a burnout enough to fit in with the burnouts. I was, like, right in the middle. Even the jocks in my school were super smart, which was, like, you don't understand that feeling when, like, people who are, like, popular, great at sports are also geniuses.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm like, fuck off. But that's the feeling I connect to a lot with, like, the way Miles went through with this. I'm just like, even amongst spider people who share his powers, he still feels like a loner.
Yeah.
And, like, he truly has to find his own path. I mean, that's something that I think a lot of people could connect to, but I think that's something that really spoke to me.
Yeah, for sure. I, like, you know, I was a terrible student growing up. At least student. Like I was one of those kids, and this carried on pretty much until college, where teachers loved me when I was in class, but I was a terrible, like I wasn't good at keeping up with my homework and doing the work. But in the actual class, I was smart and engaged and understood what was going on a lot of the time.
Yeah.
So the word I heard passed around for me a lot was potential, you know?
Well, that's something I feel like Miles goes through a lot in the beginning, like, 10 minutes of this movie.
Yeah.
What I loved about it is that all the adults in Miles' life are actually really kind of supportive, but they're trying to be like, Miles, you got so much more in you.
Yeah.
Like, obviously his parents.
Mm-hmm.
Like, Miles, you earned this place for the school. And it's like, I just won the lottery, right? And his teacher of just like if you got every answer wrong in multiple choice, if you guessed every answer, you would still get 50-50. You really have to try to get every answer wrong. You have to know the answers.
Yeah.
And she's like, I'm not going to let you quit. Which, by the way, props to this movie to being, like, showing a good teacher.
Yeah, not just, like, always miserable teachers.
And I'm like, fuck yeah, she actually cares. It's so cool, you know, which is what most teachers are like, you know. It's really cool. And even Uncle Aaron. Aaron is like, Miles, you can talk to these girls, whatever. You got to have confidence and all that stuff. Like, all these adults are kind of like, believe in Miles more than Miles believe in himself. And then it doesn't happen until he takes a leap of faith for him to believe in himself.
Well, that's really what it comes down to for Miles, is that leap of faith aspect. Is like, think, like, he's wired, and a lot of people are wired this way, to seek comfort at all times. You know, he can't handle the actual, like, yeah, that unknown, that fear of the unknown. He has to know for sure that he will be a successful Spider-Man. He has to know for sure he will get the girl, whatever it is, you know?
Yeah.
And so I think it's a very universal feeling that makes Miles a very easy to relate to protagonist.
I think the reason you like him is the moment it cuts to him, mm-hmm. right? So let's zoom out for a second. We open this movie with this great, like, let's do this one last time. Immediately is just like, oh, this movie gets it.
Yeah, we've seen Chris Pine.
And we've seen the origin story so many times. And that's part of what I mean. It's like, this movie understands that you've seen this a lot. So we're just going to, like, go through it for the people who haven't. And it's Chris Pine, which is such a great find when you're like, oh, that was Chris Pine.
Yeah.
Which you've seen now, Dungeons and Dragons.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Chris Pine's so great in it. And he's just, like, he seems perfect for that, like, just winning, charming role.
Yeah, I liked him as Captain Kirk, too. I thought he was still fun, you know?
You know, I need to see this Star Trek.
J.J. Abrams Star Trek movies?
I've never seen it, yeah.
I mean, I'm not a Trekkie, so I have no real, like...
take on, like, whether it was loyal to...
Yeah, exactly. But in general, I'm like, Chris Pine's a fun, you know, leading man.
Yeah, from what I've heard about a lot of people, is at least the first one's just this fun, like, action romp.
Yeah.
But he says the line of just, like, there's only one Spider-Man... and he winks, and then it hard cuts to Miles, and he's singing Post Malone's Sunflower.
Yeah.
And he's singing it, but he's kind of stuttering through it a little bit. And in the theater, like, that was an immediate laugh. And I also was like, oh man, we're in good hands. Cause it's such a, like, that song came out a few months before that movie came out.
Yeah.
We all loved it. But it was an immediate, like, oh man, that's how I sing that song. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And immediately it makes you feel connected to the character.
Well, it's a great, like, I don't know what you call it, great movie song, you know, how there's always, like, songs that connect to the movie. Because it's the song that calms Spider-Man down as well. Like, it actually has an effect on the story.
Yeah.
It's not just like, oh, we'll just play this during the credits, call it a day.
Yeah, no, totally. I think, like, it'll always be connected to Spider-Man, obviously.
Yeah.
But if you look at the lyrics, too, it's such a great Spider-Man song.
Yeah.
Also, like, I think the most recent movie to have that effect is Top Gun Maverick, that Lady Gaga song, Take My Hand.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm like, that song is so Top Gun. Like, not only because it came out for Top Gun, but it's just like, there's something about it. You listen to it and you just see planes flying through sunset. Like, it's just so perfect.
Yeah, and Lady Gaga is, like, a great choice for an artist to kind of have that blend of, like, being modern but still paying homage to that time.
Yeah, it feels old school. It feels like swooning a little bit. But then it's just like, it swings for the fences the same way Top Gun Maverick does. And like, you know, Sunflower has that same feeling of just like this kid waiting to come out. You know what I mean? Yeah. He has a lot of stuff bottled in. It's so beautiful. Then you're like, just like, you're immediately thrown into this world. Like, he leaves his house and he doesn't want to be dropped off. He's like, I'll walk or whatever.
Yeah.
And immediately throwing stickers up on signs. Like, he has this block that knows him. And he's like, Miles, where were you last night? And everyone. It's like, what's cool about it, though, is that, like, okay, this guy's cool among his community, but he's leaving his community. And he's about to become an outsider, and he's really nervous about it.
Yeah. And there's this wall between him and his father, obviously, because he doesn't want to ride from his dad. You know, obviously he's embarrassed to even be seen in a car with him, which is like a universal thing. We all don't like being embarrassed by our parents and go to school.
But,
you
know? Speaking on the dad, there's a literal, like, a lot of the scenes, what was cool about it is that a lot of the scenes, there's literally a wall there. So, like, he's in the police car. There's that cage in front of him. Even when he leaves the police car and he's like, say I love you, Miles.
Yeah.
There's, like, a line of cones. When his dad comes to talk to him about Uncle Aaron dying, there's that wall.
They especially make it clear in that shot, too.
Then at the end, when they're having that phone call, and he's like, Miles, I don't know if I came by to tell you. He's like, I know, Dad.
Yeah.
After the fight's over. And he, like, they're trying to open up to each other, but they're both, like, just, they're both so similar in the way they can't just say it. So Miles literally puts back on the mask and goes hugs his dad as Spider-Man. And it's basically like Spider-Man helps him break the wall between him and his dad.
Yeah, it's the only way he knows how to effectively connect with them.
I mean,
but it's also,
I'm going to cry right now.
I know, but it's so powerful because also his dad is so open about his disdain for Spider-Man too. And so it's almost like his own way of trying to get his dad to break down his own walls and change him too.
This movie, like, especially watching it this time, I've seen this movie so many times, but while I was watching it this time, what stood out to me was the father-son story.
Sure, yeah.
Especially, yeah. I think the parents in general. This is another reason why this is such a unique Spider-Man story, is we're so used to Spider-Man not having parents, losing Uncle Ben, being with Aunt May, and that's a dynamic that's strong on its own.
Yeah.
But I think it was cool to see, okay, this is something different. We're seeing two parents that not only are very supportive and loving, but also, they work for public service.
Yeah, and what's cool, though, is that, yeah, it's very true, like you said, public service.
She's a nurse, he's a cop. They're both trying their best to help their city.
Yeah, they're both trying to contribute in their own ways. I think what's cool is that it does still echo Peter Parker's emotional journey in its own way. If you look at the first Raimi movie, at least, and we won't get too into it, just because we're covering this movie.
Yeah.
But the whole thing in the first movie is that Peter Parker was rejecting Uncle Ben as his father figure. He literally says, then stop pretending to be, when he says he's not his father.
Yeah.
And at the end of the first Spider-Man movie, he says, I have a father. His name was Ben Parker.
Oh, yeah.
So Peter Parker deals with his own, you know, father figure issues the same way. But it's just, like you said, it's very different with Miles.
There's a line that that Miles says at the end that I wrote as, this is their version of I have a father, his name is Ben Parker. Just remind me to say what that line is when we talk to closer to the end. Because I don't want to, I want to leave the end to the end, you know?
Yeah.
But yeah, he's going to this new school. It's a smarty pants school. And they do this like really snappy montage. And this is where like the animation is really showing off. Like it's really showing itself. Which I think, let's touch on it a little bit, how loyal this movie is to like the comic books in terms of literal structure, in terms of like showing panels and the speech bubbles.
Oh,
and all
yeah,
that
it's
stuff.
Not even a competition, right? Like, I think you can literally pause, and I did this when I was watching it. You can pause at any point during the movie, and it looks like a great comic panel. Like, the framing or whatever you want to call it, like the motion is so natural. Like, there's no like, oh, this part's blurry or this part's clearly rushed. Like, every frame's so precise. There's so many tiny details. Like, they went so hard on it, even down to like, do you remember like the, you know, the bagel part? Do you know what I'm talking about? When he throws the bagel.
Oh, yeah, yeah. It's a great bit. And then like he throws the bagel and it hits the guy. Then you see a little,
you see the word bagel pop up in text.
Bagel pop. Okay, yeah. That's what it was. It was some sort of like onomatopoeia or whatever.
Yeah, but even like, or when, you know, when, not to get too all over the place, but when Peter B. Parker's montage is going, when he's introducing himself, remember how he says, I made some dicey money choices, and it says never invest in a restaurant?
Yeah.
When you see him holding the review in the newspaper, I paused it, and there's a whole ass written review on the newspaper.
And I think like it really showed itself in the school scene for me, like in Miles' first day in school, because it's literally cutting to close-ups, and it has this editing style where you hear echoes of their like lessons.
Yeah, kind of layered into each other.
And it layers into a score, and it feels like the movie just feels so alive.
Yeah.
I think the visual like comic book homages matched with like Daniel Pemberton's score. The score, unbelievable. Yeah. Unbelievable music. Like
it's a masterpiece. The whole thing, literally every piece of this movie is masterful.
I've listened to the soundtrack and score to this movie so many times that like just on my own, going for a walk, going for a run, you know, and just like on a plane, like just listen to it so much that when I was watching this movie, I was just like, I feel like I've heard this movie so many times.
Yeah.
And we didn't even mention it, but just the way that it starts with all the like studio logos glitching out, you know?
Yeah, it gives you a little taste of what it's doing. Like, hey, you see the Columbia Pictures logo with like a couple different looks.
Even like Pascal Pictures changing.
Yeah.
And then it does the boom up, approved by like the Comics Authority or whatever. It's such a beautiful like love letter. It's cheesy to say, but it is, you know? A beautiful love letter to not only Spider-Man, but to comic books. Like, we've seen so many comic book movies, superhero movies. They became the main blockbuster movie that people would go see. At the same time, it felt like this was the first movie that understood what comic books are and what reading a comic book feels like.
Yeah, yeah. It had this, it felt like all of the animators like kind of moved to a new city that's completely empty and just started building the new city there. Like, as weird as that metaphor was or parallel, but like it literally felt like they just had so many fucking ideas and were just going hard with full confidence.
Yeah. And I've never felt a movie truly understand what it feels like to read a graphic novel or to read a comic book, where it can be like visually overwhelming at times. You're trying to figure out what to look at.
And what's cool about comics, going off of that, jumping in, is that like, because they're so structured, like the panels and the actual individual images are art pieces that are hand-drawn often, is that you can like look into and see details in the framing and the structure of it overall, and can get kind of your own interpretations of it, right? Like Watchmen is one of the obvious examples of like most of the pages have 9 panels, and it has this very clockwork kind of structure to it when you read it.
Yeah.
And so I think it was just a really fantastic translation to put that on screen.
Totally. And it's also just doing so much work in setting stuff up for the story in the background when, like, Miles comes in late in the class that Gwen's sitting in. You see in the back, like, Dr. Octavia is, like, in the video that they're showing, too. They're setting up so many tiny little things. Another thing that's kind of unique about this movie, and along with the soundtrack, along with, like, the visuals, is kind of the cast.
Yeah.
The cast is a perfect mix of, like, well-known, like, actors, but also just, like, very diverse, you know, in a way that's not showy, but it's just, like, that's just the world that they're living in.
Yeah, just, like, you would never expect to see these actors, like, intermingling, like, seeing Nick Cage and John Mulaney and Hailee Steinfeld all in the same scene together.
Exactly. Like, Shameik Moore, let's shout him out. He's Miles Morales. Amazing.
Fantastic.
Like, a great voice performance.
Yeah.
And truly I feel so much empathy for this character, and that's all because of him.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Jake Johnson as Peter B. Parker, which we're going to talk a lot about. Hailee Steinfeld as Gwen Stacy.
Yeah.
Mahershala Ali as Uncle Aaron.
Yo, yeah.
Who, when Uncle Aaron just shows up and you hear his smooth voice, I'm like, who else could it be?
Yeah.
And then there's a lot, like, right? Lily Tomlin. Lily Tomlin as Aunt May.
Yeah.
Zoe Kravitz as MJ. And then Brian Tyree Henry, our dude. Like, our guy.
That's our boy.
So, for people who don't know, Chris and I are huge fans of Atlanta. I think it is one of our favorite shows. And I think you and I collectively, whenever we see Brian Tyree Henry pop up in, like, a red carpet, we're all just like, oh, man, he looks so fucking
He's the coolest
cool.
guy in the room all the time, man.
And he's amazing in this. He's so good.
Yeah.
But let's talk about Uncle Aaron for a second, who I think is this movie's version of Uncle Ben. I guess for Miles, he's Uncle Ben.
Yeah, I think all of them kind of play a role. Like, every, you know, like you said, regarding, like, the father figure motif in this movie is, I think, they all kind of serve different purposes. They all kind of scratch different itches for Miles.
And for Miles, he doesn't know where he belongs. And he obviously, he's at that stage of, like, puberty or whatever you want to call it, where your parents feel like they're nagging you, even though it's not the case. Every kid gets to that point in their, like, teenagehood where they just feel like, shut up, dad.
Oh, yeah, you always feel like your parents don't get you, you know?
And because Uncle Aaron is, like, the cool one that has his cool apartment that takes him out late in the night to do graffiti, he feels like the cool guy. But there's also this level of, like, Miles so badly wants to be a man, and Uncle Aaron also kind of treats him as such.
Yeah, he gives him that danger kick.
And there's, I think what's special about Miles is he's both at the same time. He's his dad and he's his uncle.
Yeah.
And, like, the movie doesn't make it, like, extremely obvious and point towards that, but it's very clear. Like, there's a part of Miles that requires that Uncle Aaron, like, confidence and bravado and having that danger, like, taking that leap of faith. He needs a little bit of Uncle Aaron in him. But the responsibility and understanding what he has, that's his dad.
Yeah, well, I think that's what what Miles is caught between throughout the whole movie, right? Even Peter B. Parker plays a role in that as well, because he's also afraid of dealing with the responsibilities and, like, the real consequences of what he's done in his life. Because throughout the whole movie, Peter B. Parker wants to stay behind and, like, oh, I'll die with the machine, because he just doesn't want to go back home because he's afraid of rebuilding his life.
Okay, let's talk about Peter B. Parker.
Yeah, now
I think it's time.
Let's.
So, first of all, we yada yada through this a little bit, but yeah, he goes, does graffiti with Uncle Aaron, gets bit by the spider, and suddenly has that big Spider-Man moment.
Yeah.
Which, in every Spider-Man iteration, those moments are kind of my favorite. It's like the equivalent of in a heist movie when you're getting the team together, how that sequence is always fun no matter how cliched it is. Like, in a Spider-Man movie, when he's getting his powers, I'm always excited. Like, you know?
Yeah, it's always, like, kind of fun and game sequence.
And this movie does it in another unique, fresh way where you're seeing speech bubbles pop up, but then he addresses it and he's like, why is the voice inside my head so loud?
Yeah, yeah. It's a really cool way to show, like, because, you know, one of the first things that Peter Parker notices when he gets his powers is, like, how overwhelming his senses are in his reflex.
Why is my hand so big?
Yeah, it's so through animation and giving it this comic book kick, it makes it a really fresh take on it, like you said.
Yeah, and he's obviously interacting with Gwen, accidentally rips her hair off. Gwen Stacy, really charming in this. Knew, like, nothing about Spider-Woman. Knew Gwen Stacy only through, like, some comic book runs and...
Yeah, Spider-Gwen.
Spider-Gwen and Amazing Spider-Man with Emma Stone. But I feel like this is the first time where I'm like, she's dope. I want to know more about her. Across the Spider-Verse, it does a little bit more with her.
Mm-hmm.
But eventually it leads to him going back to where the spider bit him, trying to learn a little bit more, seeing that the actual Spider-Man is fighting Green Goblin, who is huge. You know how happy I was?
What, they made him out of giant rage monster?
I'm like, yes, it's so fun.
Yeah, Ultimate Spider-Man did that sort of thing. That's what's clearly inspired by. Oh yeah, you read the Ultimate Spider-Man comics. I did. So you get it, yeah.
No, that's why I was excited. I was like, oh, hell yeah.
They're doing this version of Green Goblin.
And then at the same time, they're also, you meet Kingpin, who again, is huge.
I know, they give them these kind of like expressionist kicks to it, you know.
It's so beautiful. Like Liev Schreiber, also greatest Kingpin. But then when they cut back to Kingpin, like why he's doing this, and there's these like oil art paintings of his family being taken from him, and you realize that's why. I'm like, oh, the movie didn't need to do that, but it did that.
Yeah, yeah.
Anyways, he meets Spider-Man, Chris Pine Spider-Man, who is the Spider-Man that we all have in our heads, right?
He's like the expected default kind of status quo Spider-Man that we all know.
He's like he's fun, charming, but he's also just like, you know, this bumbling guy, you know, who's kind of winning in his own way because of that.
And he knows how to relate to people. Like when he sees Miles, the first thing he points out is that his shoes are untied. I don't have to deal with it because I got this onesie on, you know?
Yeah. And it's like, oh man, that's great. It kind of reminds me of that Amazing Spider-Man 2 scene. Where he's fixing that kid's little, like, machine that he has.
Yeah, yeah. That's always a lovely moment, isn't it?
Where he's just like, you made this? No way. Really? Oh, that's really cool.
And he webs it to fix it.
He's like, what's your name? And he says his name. He's like, I'm Spider-Man.
Yeah, he, like, walks him home afterwards.
That's, like, the one beautiful scene in that movie. But anyways, there's that awesome moment where he's just like, I don't think you have much choice, kid, when Miles is like, I don't want this.
Mm-hmm.
And he's like, it's okay, I can help you out with this. Like, you know, I can train you and everything. And he's like, okay, cool. And then he's like, all right, I'll be right back. And then does this awesome swinging montage, right? Eventually, Kingpin does the Kingpin pound on him.
Mm-hmm. Clearly, he took a page from Daredevil right there, the way he did that smash.
But it's also like a comic book thing of the Kingpin, like, that's how he kills people.
Yeah, you're right. They're right. Daredevil didn't invent it, but I think it did popularize it, though. The way Kingpin in the Daredevil show, like, kills people. He has this kind of toddler-like way of killing people.
It's my favorite. Well, I think the Vincent D'Onofrio Kingpin, the best part about him is that he is basically a little kid.
He's a giant baby, is essentially what he is. He's a giant bald baby.
Oh, man.
I would like my rattle to be brought to me, please.
Give me my Baba. Someone burp me.
Burping Vincent D'Onofrio in your arms.
Holding him.
Listeners, I put my thumb in my mouth like I'm Vincent D'Onofrio sucking my thumb,
yeah,
by
so
the way.
Join the YouTube channel for stuff like this.
For more incredible content, come to our YouTube channel.
All leading up to, basically, Miles having this interaction with Peter Parker, and Peter being like, here, you need to shut that off because everything's going to go to hell, and you got this. And Miles obviously doesn't succeed in that, and he like buys this cheapo mask from the store, like a cheapo Spider-Man costume, and that's where we get our Stan Lee cameo.
Oh, yeah, yeah, and he says the suit always fits eventually, and the camera whips over and you see the no refund sign.
Yeah, you think it's gonna be this like sentimental line from Stan Lee. It's also one of the last like Stan Lee cameos.
Yeah, yeah.
And so he's already passed away by the time this movie comes out. And so you're just like, oh, and then it does that whip pan and you're like, oh, that's perfect. It's a great joke. Yeah, yeah, he can't, like, he tries to like even jump and he can't do, he falls immediately.
Yeah.
And he breaks the thing. And eventually, you know, he's at that cemetery looking at Peter Parker's grave, and suddenly someone behind him is like, hey, kids, zaps him. And it's so brilliant because they're stuck together.
Well, yeah, and A, also you learn he has a different power that you haven't seen before. You know, he has his Venom Strike, or the lightning that he shoots out, which is pretty like, oh, shoot, Spider-Man can shoot lightning, at least for people who aren't familiar with Miles Morales. That's like a whole different thing.
Totally. Totally, yeah. I mean, I think that's the advantage this movie has, too, is it can show new Spider-Man powers.
Yeah, it shows new Spider-Man powers, and, like, they effectively use all of his powers as kind of a metaphor for coming of age and, like, kind of figuring out as you develop as the weird chaos that your body does and the way your brain goes and things you worry about. You know, even after the... You know, when he's first coming to school with his powers, how he's walking, like, oh, they all can see me. Oh my God, everyone's looking at me. This is embarrassing.
Yeah.
It's like, we've all dealt with that at a base level as a teenager, but they just took it into the Spider-Man formula, you know?
It's interesting. Like, many, like, Spider-Man movies have done that. Except the Tom Holland one, which it just jumps you straight into, he's been Spider-Man for a year.
Yeah.
But, like, no movie has tackled the metaphor that hard as this movie does.
Yeah.
It, like, dives so hard into it.
The part that gets me as well, always, not like emotionally, but just in a funny way it gets me, is when his hand sticks to Gwen Stacy's hair and how it's like stuck and he's like pulling on it. Did I ever, I'm pretty sure I told you this embarrassing story, but just for listeners, I told, you know, the sauce bottle story.
You got to say it. Yeah.
I told you that story. You know the story. So for listeners and viewers. So when I was like 17, my family owned a food truck.
Yeah.
For a little bit, and I did some work on it. You know, I served customers, and there are these cute girls.
Were they hot dogs? What was the food?
Yeah, that's integral to this story. Yeah. It actually is.
Yeah.
They were hot dogs, and it was several things. It was dogs and little sliders and things like that.
You see, viewers and listeners, I knew it was hot dogs.
Yeah.
But I'm a podcaster, so I ask questions for context.
you're guiding them through this. I appreciate it for you. I appreciate you is what I meant to say. But,
thank you.
There are these cute girls that I was ringing up, you know, also my age, like other teenagers. And so it was like at a window and I was still chatting with them. I wasn't really trying to chat them up, but I was trying to be a cool, like, ooh, I'm a cool young, you know, food truck worker.
You're trying to be a bartender, but with hot dogs.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. a dog tender. And so I had a hot dog and I was talking her through it. And there was like a little clog in the sauce bottle, like it wouldn't come out. And listeners, if you ever have a clogged bottle, don't squeeze the bottle harder like a fucking moron. But that's what I did when I was a kid. And so instead of like taking the cap off and seeing where the clog was and just removing it, I was just squeezing. Like, why isn't this working? And the fucking thing exploded like crazy, just like right all over the sauce. And hunks of sauce. And I could see it. This girl was standing in front of me. I could see hunks of sauce in her hair. And I was like, you know, oh my God, I'm so sorry. And she was like, no, it's okay. Like, kind of grabbing napkins.
That's the part. So, like, you've told me this story many times now. And, like, every time you retell the story to me, it's the part where she's, like, cleaning out her hair that
it's so cringy, isn't it? It's so sad.
So much.
And, dude, my dad would not let it go. He was laughing so hard at me.
Yeah, and we're jumping around a lot here, but like your dad laughing at you just reminded me of that great like Miles' dad moment where they're in the car. Who's just like, look what that coffee shop's called. Isn't that crazy? Like, I mean, they're just popping up and people are lining up for them. It's like, Dad, you're so old. Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah. No, I mean, like, it is a great, like, way of just getting everyone to connect with Miles. That moment where he's like, it's a girl he really likes, and he's like, oh my God.
Yeah, and again, it's a baseline metaphor for when you go through puberty and you have awkward interactions. We've all had cringy stories with girls like that.
That's a nice haircut. You don't get to like my haircut.
Yeah, exactly.
But yeah, so he immediately is, like, attached with Peter B. Parker, literally.
Mm-hmm.
And they just start swinging off.
Yeah, he starts kind of trying to wrangle him properly, leap, and then still getting caught in the web and using his hand as a web shooter.
It's such a beautiful introduction to both of them. Like, when they both meet, it's so chaotic, and it's immediately, like, they're just slamming through New York.
Oh, and this is only, like, 20 minutes into the movie. Oh, like, this movie moves so fast.
There's so much that happens. It's wild.
It does a great job of, like, yeah, like you said, it's introducing the characters through a high tension, fun, rambunctious chase.
Yes.
You know, because you just see the cops saying stuff like, you know, we have a man dressed as Spider-Man dragging a homeless corpse through New York.
Listen, here's the thing. I love No Way Home. I love it so much. I was there in the theater when Tobey Maguire came out of that fucking portal, and I was like, oh my God.
Yeah. Oh, you remember? I was like fully shouted in the theater with you.
We all did. It was amazing.
Yeah.
I will say, Peter B. Parker coming in this story and immediately like Miles zapping him, and then they have to run away, go like swing away from the cops, and them slamming into that subway of the kids seeing them and getting scared. Like, that's such a, like, more, like, that's such a better way to do it just because it's being done through action.
Yeah, yeah.
And, but I don't want to compare the two, but I'm just saying, like, watching the Into Spider-Verse again for the first time after seeing No Way Home, I was like, wow, I kind of like how they did it in here, you know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, they both serve very different functions, to be fair, right? You know what I mean? They both have very different, like...
No Way Home, I guess, needs to give you that moment of, like, let's breathe, Andrew Garfield's here.
Yeah, exactly. You know, not to get too, you know, deep into that one, but I do think that they both are different in their own ways. They have, they're in different lanes.
I will say, though, you know, I do love how in No Way Home, when Andrew Garfield arrives, he takes off his mask, and there's this moment where he's like,
and he, like, oh, yeah, there's a pause clearly for audience cheers.
Yeah, and I'm like, I love that they knew, it's like, people are gonna freak out, so let's leave 3-4 seconds of breathing room here.
Yeah, they have to edit it in such a precise way.
And they did the same thing when Tobey Maguire came out. They gave many reaction shots to make sure people are not talking over dialogue. So I can't tell you how funny it was to see the Peter B. Parker origin story in a theater. You were there. You remember.
Yeah, yeah.
How amazing it was to feel like, okay, we're introducing to a new version of Spider-Man. He's Peter B. Parker. All right, interesting. A little weird. Oh, he's in his late 30s and he's having a crisis.
He's like a washed up Spider-Man. That's clearly, like, it's meant to be kind of the epilogue in a way of Sam Raimi's Spider-Man.
And it's immediately throwing you into something that you haven't seen before.
Yeah.
And it feels so personal because you're watching a Spider-Man that you grew up with, in a way. Like, the way I look at it is, like, let's say if the Raimi Spider-Man, like the Tobey Maguire Spider-Man, after those first three movies, what happened to him? Like, we have this great memory of him, of this guy who stood against all the odds and fought his own demons, right?
Yeah, defeated Doc Ock, got the girl, you know.
But what if, like, 10 years later, he divorced the girl because of his own shortcomings and insecurities? Like, what if, like, he went downhill and didn't believe in himself anymore? And it feels way more personal and so funny. Like, when you see him put on the sweatpants and he has a gun.
Down a burger. I know.
It's a pizza.
Well, no, when they're sitting together, he's eating a burger. But yeah, you're right, you're right. When he's in his own place, he's eating a pizza.
When he's just like, and one night, you know, I was doing sit-ups, getting strong.
Yeah, just cuts to his bulging gut.
And what a unique invention.
Yeah, they did a great job of, I think what made it work too is it didn't feel like a, you know, an anti-Spider-Man of, like, trying to shock you with how different he was. It felt like a realistic, like, it walked you through how he became this way and how he's really just the Spider-Man that's tired and has lost that part of himself, which I think is pretty universal when it comes to getting older.
Totally. I'm going to give a comparison that you're probably going to hate, but I just want you to go with me.
Okay. Go with you as in not fight you on it, because I think I know where you're taking it.
Okay. Maybe you know.
I think I know. Get it over with.
Do you know?
I think I know.
Okay.
Yeah, go for it.
I don't think you know. So you said that Peter B. Parker is not, like, he's still, like, you can tell that he's still Spider-Man, right? Mm-hmm. He's still lovable, which I think is key. Like, when he comes back, yeah, he's washed up and everything, but you don't hate him. Like, there's still so much to love for him. He's relatable still, like, because of all the stuff that he's going through, you know? And he's just weathered and sad, like you said. I think Luke Skywalker from Last Jedi is like this, but they just went a little too far with Last Jedi.
Well, yeah, I mean, this Peter B. Parker didn't run away to another area and hide.
Yes.
I think that's the core difference.
I think, you know, I think you thought we were going to be in disagreement here.
Yeah.
I agree with you. I think it's a similar approach that, like, they did with Last Jedi, right? But they just, it felt like that character didn't even feel like Luke anymore. There was no resemblance of Luke in there.
They had, like, inkling moments, for sure, where you can see that person would come back.
When he talks to R2.
Yeah, and then he sees Leia again, all that stuff, you know.
Yeah, but I think this one did a better job of it. Because it's like, okay, they're going for the weathered, sad feeling that this guy goes through life and things happen, where you become a little bit more cynical. But he's still Spider-Man. He still wants to save the day. He still wants to help. Like you said, it's not like he's not putting on the suit anymore.
Yeah, yeah, totally, totally. And also, like, he's still engaging in Spider-Man activities. He's going on the mission with Miles. They're both going together to the lab. You know what I mean? And he was also going to do it himself. You know, he was like, yeah, you stay back here, I'll do it.
And, well, that's also interesting.
It's also interesting that Peter B. Parker is like, I'll sacrifice myself and do it. Yeah. And usually in any other superhero movie, that would be like, that's Spider-Man, right? Mm-hmm. But in this one, it's just like, no, you're just doing that because you're scared to go back home.
Yeah, he feels like he has nothing else. He feels like he has kind of nothing to live for at this
point. It's Miles holding him. It's like, you got to go home, man.
Yeah.
We'll get to it. But you know what I mean,
though? Oh, totally. 100%. Yeah.
I couldn't help think about that. I'm like, oh, this is the right version of what they were trying to do in Last Jedi.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. We don't have to talk about Last Jedi that much anymore.
All right, guys.
Trying to... Our channel gets a copyright strike. We're like, what? No. Why?
Not this one.
Why did this video get blocked?
But, yeah, no, I 100% agree. I also think, like, you know... It is, like you said, it is a very relatable still Peter Parker because, like, yeah, that does happen when you get older.
Yeah.
You know? Like, I think I touched on this, you know, maybe off mic. I don't even remember if I said it in this recording or not. But I think a lot of the curse of being Spider-Man is, like, the exhaustion and pain that comes with being Spider-Man.
Yeah.
In terms of, like, doing the right thing often takes sacrifice in some capacity.
Yeah. And, like... There was something interesting about this, like, Peter B. Parker Spider-Man feeling just actually just physically exhausted, not just, like, you know, spiritually or emotionally, but physically exhausted. Like, before he goes on the mission, he's stretching now. Like, yeah. He doesn't just swing everywhere. He takes the bus because it's easier.
Yeah, exactly. He's adapted. He's like, I'm not doing that just because it's cool.
He's not wearing the full costume. He's wearing sweatpants now because that's more comfortable. So it's like both, like, yes, emotionally exhausted, but also physically. But the thing that still makes him winning is he's trying.
Yeah.
And I think that's why you want to root for him. There's a tricky balance with this kind of character.
Yeah, he's a Spider-Man that wants to succeed still, so therefore you want him to succeed because you know who Spider-Man is and you know what's in there.
But just like Miles doesn't believe in himself to fully become who he wants to become, Peter B. Parker has lost faith in himself. Mm-hmm. He had it and lost it. And that's like where it's so such a beautiful writing how they come together and how their arcs complete for each other.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I think they both learn something from each other too. And Miles has trouble finding his place. And then once, and we can get to it if you want to just transition here, once he meets all of the other spider people, you want to just go for it and just
let's
talk
go
about
for it.
So Spider-Man Noir, Spider-Gwen, Spider-Pig.
So immediately, so like Spider-Gwen introduces herself after they get out and steal the server. And you get that fun moment where he's teaching him how to swing.
Yeah.
And he's like, all right, kid, you're getting it. Wait a second. Do I want kids?
Yeah. I think what's so cool, too, is that we already said, is that it's all done through action and stakes. There's no, like, it's not like he just takes him out to a building and just says, okay, just swing right here. It's like life or death. So it feels urgent.
Action is driving the story and character building is happening on the way.
Yeah.
It's not stopping the story. It's not stopping the action. So they meet Spider-Gwen. She tells her backstory of she lost her best friend and she's a loner. And you get the same format of like, let's do this one last time. And immediately it's a different artwork too.
Yeah, the aesthetic completely changes. The music changes.
Yeah.
The whole vibe changes.
So those three meet and they go to Aunt May's house. And there is this beautiful moment where he's like, I'm not ready for this. And what's beautiful about that is because we as Spider-Man fans, like, have a relationship with Aunt May.
Yeah, yeah. And how the house is kind of shaped the same way as the Sam Raimi one.
I know. And the interior later in the day when you see the sofa, you're like, it feels like the Raimi Spider-Man house.
I know.
Like, they knew. You know what I mean?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they totally knew.
So Aunt May basically, like, oh, you're from another dimension. I know there's other people. You're not the only ones. She takes them down to this, like, extravagant lair.
Yeah, the Batcave, basically.
Where there's all those suits, you know? And had the Spider-Man Insomniac game come out by the time?
Well, the Insomniac suit's in there, too, if you look at that row of suits.
Okay, that's what I was going to point out. I saw that suit, and I was wondering if it was vice versa, if they were inspired.
No, or... I think they both came out the same year. I think both of them came out in 2018.
Because I remember... Okay. I do remember in the theater being like, oh, it's like the video games and everything, you know? They come down and he's like, okay, wait a second. You're going to need these. And they're hello, my name is tags.
Yeah.
And it suddenly cuts. He's like, it's Spider-Man Noir and his wind is blowing.
Yeah, I know. He even points it out. It's like, where is that wind coming from? We're underground.
it's Penny Parker.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
she has her, like, you know, robot.
That's controlled by a little spider inside of it.
I love how weird it is. I love how weird both noir and this. And then it's just like, can't get any weirder. It can get weirder.
Immediately you hear John Mulaney, I'm Spider Pig.
I love that it's John Mulaney so much. And also, wait, it's Peter Porker.
Yeah, Peter Porker.
Peter Porker does have a great badass moment that, like, I kind of, like, I think I clapped in the theater for. Everyone else did too, but we'll get to it. This is where the movie just, like, explodes a little bit, right? We get all three origin stories at the same time. My favorite is just, like, Peter Porker.
Of course, yeah.
Who's like, and I'm here looking for the latest scoop. He's a journalist.
Well, and he was also, wasn't he bitten by a radioactive pig? Wasn't he something else? I got a brief glimpse of it, but he was another species that a pig bit and turned him into the pig.
He's Peter Porker now.
I know. I wish John Mulaney did more voice roles, to be honest.
He is kind of, well, I mean, it kind of like, his voice is so distinct.
Yeah.
It works for this, but it's so distinct that I think it like kind of couldn't work unless it was Peter Porker. And they lean into the fact that they got John Mulaney.
Oh, I know. And Nick Cage, obviously, is just, the fuck is Nick Cage doing in this movie? It's so cool.
It's like, in my free time, I'm beating Nazis.
Yeah, come on, put him on. He has this old 30s slang.
Sometimes I light a match to see how it can burn. Like, he's just very much like gothic, like noir.
My favorite was a small touch when they're all listing out the people they've lost. Remember how it was like Michael Ben?
Oh, yes.
And then it was just him just being Michael Benjamin.
Dude, I wrote this. I literally wrote it down in my notes. It's like one of my favorite lines in the movie. It's my Uncle Benjamin.
It's like just a little bit more 30s. They didn't have to do that, but they did.
Oh, man. I'm going to take this with me. I don't know what it is, but I will find out. And it's a Rubik's Cube. Yeah,
yeah. I know. He's like, is this purple? No.
I was always kind of bummed out that they spoiled it in the trailer. But I mean, the movie's called Into the Spider-Verse, so you knew. But I kind of, like, the first trailer, you only saw Gwen and Peter B. Parker. So they could have still pulled it off. I was kind of bummed out. And then I was also worried. I'm like, that's too many characters. Like, how are they going to pull it off? Yeah, but I think the movie does a smart thing, which is like, they are just going to be the movie starts to get very serious the second half. After all they're introduced, like, Miles' story gets way more serious.
Yeah.
And so they're there to genuinely provide the comedic relief.
Yeah, I think the stakes get raised primarily when, I would say, Uncle Aaron dies. That's probably when, like, things get really pretty intense.
And to be fair, now that I'm thinking about it, it's not just comedic relief. It's there to add pressure to Miles.
Yeah.
To just, again, it's that moment where they're all gathered around him. It's like, can he do it? Can he get... Sorry, I froze.
It's just for listeners and viewers. I had a visual or a visual. Now I'm fucking up my speech.
We're both short circuiting. We're both glitching out. We belong in another dimension.
Yeah. That's what this is.
No, but basically they're all there, just being like, when you fall down, can you get back up? Can you do all the things that we Spider-Men can do? That's been mythologized too. You know what I mean? With great power comes great responsibility. And Peter B. Parker believes in him. And he's like, he can do it. He can't do it on command, but he can do it, you know? And Gwen's kind of on his side, but still, Miles feels like a loner. He disappears, goes away.
Yeah.
And finds out about Uncle Aaron, who's actually the Prowler.
Yeah, yeah.
And it is like a, I mean, I know, I've seen this movie so many times, but it is like a pretty dramatic reveal.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know what's funny is like the comic people knew it just because like I just already knew it going into it because Aaron Davis was in the MCU as well.
Homecoming. He was in Homecoming. Yeah, Donald Glover.
Exactly. And so I knew that because I looked up who Aaron Davis was because when he says I got a nephew, I was like, oh, MCU's too particular to have lines like that. And then he realized, oh, he's mentioning Miles Morales. And then he's also the Prowler. I wonder if they're setting him up to be a villain. So as soon as I saw Uncle Davis was in this movie, I was like, oh, Prowler, cool, purple guy, right on, you know?
Yeah.
But it is still a really intense reveal. And I think what made it cool is, not only when Miles discovers it when he's camouflaged, hiding, and he takes his mask off and all that, but also that their direct relationship was there when Miles took his mask off and Aaron didn't kill him. You know, he was about to, and then he realized he froze, and that's what cost him his life.
Yeah.
You know, that Fisk just took that from him immediately.
I know. And also, like, Before we get to that scene, really quickly, just want to just shout out how amazing that chase sequence is.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, how dangerous it genuinely feels. Like, when he gets on that bike, you know, it's terrifying.
Yeah.
Yeah, but then he's in, they're all in Aunt May's house, and it's a beautiful action sequence. Because everyone's has a role, everyone's doing something. You know, we finally see Penny Parker's robot finally in full form. Spider-Man Noir's fighting. Peter Porker's also going at it. But then you also see Aunt May seeing her furniture like being removed, and she starts attacking too. And they're all like, "You gotta go home, man." Like, to Miles.
Yeah,
they're all like, "You gotta get out of here. You don't belong.
Like, you're not ready." Basically,
Miles and Uncle Aaron sequence happens. Uncle Aaron dies. And they're all in the dorm with Miles being like, "Listen, man, we all go through this. You're not ready. It's a leap of faith. You never know." And he webs him up.
Yeah.
It's a sad scene, too, because Peter B. Parker doesn't want it. And he's like giving it to him straight.
Yeah.
And then is probably like a scene that I think every time I watch it, I tear up. And it's a scene with him and his dad.
Of course. Yeah.
I without fail, I cry every time. It's that scene and then a scene that happens later. And it's like literally father son can't talk to each other. Like his mouth is taped and like he can't say anything to his dad, and his dad is trying to get through to his son. There's still this divide between them.
Yeah, yeah, that's it. Feels like all of those little plants that they set up in the beginning, you know, down to, you know, when he asks him, "Do you hate Spider-Man?" He's like, "Well, you know," and the mom's always defending him, and you can hear them talking about it outside the door. You know, of being like, "Well, no, I'm just trying to toughen him up," or whatever he says. You know, there's always this kind of like barrier between them. And so I think all of it comes to this dramatic kind of climax between them emotionally.
"I love you. You don't have to say it back."
Yeah.
Like,
yeah, that's just devastating.
There's this feeling of like, maybe I will never get to know who you really are, but I do love you.
He expressed like real support where he basically says like, "You don't have to. You know, again, you don't have to say I love you back, but I, you know," he basically says, "I see this spark in you." He says that to him.
Yeah. You know? And what the important part that he says is that "I see this spark in you, but it's yours.
Yeah.
You can do whatever you want with it." And that is truly like the most important line I feel like he says, because it's like a, "I love you and I've realized that I can't control what you do. Even if I see some sort of potential, you're going to do with it what you think is right."
Yeah.
"And I trust you and I love you."
Yeah. It's pure, selfless, parental love.
And that's what gives him the push to like do the whole like break through the webs and finally make that leap.
Yeah, he breaks through the webs using his Venom Strike too, which is cool because it's like his unique power that none of the other Spider-Men have. Because that's like the whole thing, right?
You have a spark within you and you'll do whatever you want with
it. Yeah, he activates that fucking spark immediately. Because I think like, yeah, that's the whole thing they were trying to ask. What can you do? You know, can you do this? Can you, he's like, "Can you be caught boggled down by the moral ambiguity of your actions?" Whatever he said. I forgot what the line was. But like, I think Miles having these specific powers that he can't control, but he chooses to take control of them and embrace it and figure out what he has to offer to the world. It's a very universal thing that people have, right? Everyone has that thing when they're coming of age where you're like, "Where the fuck am I supposed to be? What college am I going to go to? Do I even want to go to college? Where am I taking my life?" There's always that thing of like, and people are still in my ear all the time, like, "Oh, you're smart. You should do this. You're smart. You should do that. Ah, you're not going to go anywhere. You're not smart." You know?
Yeah.
People hear all sorts of things growing up in their ear. And so it's so hard to find out what you really want to do. And so I think that whole buildup is a really cool way. Again, this whole movie is kind of just a big metaphor for coming of age.
I think this is where we can talk about the leap of faith. Yeah. So, I mean, there's also this really funny scene where the roommate sees all the different Spider-Man in the corner of his dorm.
Out.
And he passes out. And they, but yeah, this causes Miles to finally like take the leap of faith. He goes to Aunt May's place. He's like, "About time you're here."
Yeah, I know. They made Aunt May this like badass, like reminds me of Margot Martindale and BoJack Horseman.
I mean, Margot Martindale and BoJack Horseman is a criminal.
Oh, no, get me wrong, but I'm just saying badass old lady. That's all we need.
Everyone should watch BoJack Horseman. A brilliant
all
show.
All roads will lead to BoJack Horseman at some point.
At least for you and I.
Yeah.
So he takes the suit. He takes the Spider-Man suit, spray paints it black, and finally goes up on the big tower.
Yeah, and just let me just jump in on the spray painting bit, because I think it's so cool that they set it up earlier that his relationship with Aaron Davis was through tagging the walls and doing that cool art piece that said
expectations
with his own silhouette over it. Yeah. So like clearly having that relationship, you know, whatever it is, street art, you know.
Well, it's the thing of just like both father figures, both his dad and his uncle are part of him.
Totally, totally. And he finds that kind of perfect blend. And so, because like they could have easily done like the Iron Man thing where he just types something in the computer, then it just prints it out for him. But the fact that he hand sprays it is a very like...
I mean, that's Spider-Man.
Yeah, well, that and also just for him, Miles personally, too. Like, Peter wouldn't... It would be weird if Peter Parker spray-painted. Yes, because well, he's not that type of guy.
He's so... Like, yeah, he would...
He's not an artist.
He usually sews his costumes. Yeah. And the fact that, like, Miles decides to do this. Like, he makes it truly his own. And it's like the movie's way of saying he was just like, we're honoring who Spider-Man is, but this is our own stamp on it. Yeah. And we're bringing Miles to the forefront. And, This leap of faith scene where he finally takes that jump is a scene that was in all the trailers.
Yeah.
And there was a point where I'm like, I've seen this scene a billion times because it shows up like in every TV spot and every YouTube ad.
It's like the poster as well.
It's the poster. And I got goosebumps from the moment that scene started in the theater, even though I'd seen it many times. Like, when it's weight, like when it carries the weight of everything that happens in the movie prior, it's still so affecting. And it's everything we love about a Spider-Man story, right? Which is him finally like taking that jump and doing that first big swing, which is what we love about Spider-Man. We always talk about the final swing, but it matches it with this movie's unique aesthetic. Mm-hmm. Which is the music. What's Up, Danger?
Yeah, I know.
What's Up, Danger became the like song you listen to while you're on a treadmill.
Like, it, like, I know, you just feel like, oh, I can do anything when I hear it.
And it's, again, the whole danger aspect you talked about, Uncle Aaron. It's
yeah.
Like that song is bringing that into the forefront, too. Of just like him confronting it, him... that danger being a part of him needing that to take the leap of faith.
Yeah, and you see the frame flip where he's going upwards too, and it's like showing that Miles is ascending.
Yeah,
basically, you know, but by jumping down, he is ascending.
And everything from like his Air Jordans like shattering against the glass.
Yeah,
and then him like going down upside down, like you said, and you see the text pop up. Woo! Oh. God.
Badass.
I know. It's still so cool. And I think we can go talk about the final act now.
Yeah. Let's do it. Because now that Miles has achieved his real transformation, right? His hero's journey. He's now, you know, or at least leading up to the final test, you know, of like now he has to come in and really step up to the plate.
Well, what's interesting is now his, like, the final arc is left up to Peter B. Parker.
Yeah.
So he makes it back to where Fisk is trying to bring back his own family. And while they're trying to stop that from happening, all the Spider-Men are kind of failing. Dr. Octavius, played by Catherine Hahn, by the way.
Yeah.
Catherine Hahn, another actress like Brian Tyree Henry. For me, whenever she pops up in anything, I'm excited. She was in, like, she's done so many like character part roles that like I just love her when she shows up.
Yeah.
And she's amazing in this. She has Peter Parker by her, like, tentacles. And then suddenly the tentacle starts punching her. And it's like, what's going on? It's like, Miles. And then Miles just pops up, like, into the camera. And it's this, like, big hero moment. He's here. And then they start swinging together. It's like, I'm so proud of you.
Yeah, that's when he says, like, do I want kids?
That's when he says it.
Yeah.
And, he basically makes it a mission of what he said, like getting everyone back home.
Yeah.
But they do, before all that happens, there's this moment where you see everyone have their hero moment. Like Spider-Man Noir is fighting all these bad guys.
Yeah. He's using his boxing style.
Penny Parker's getting pummeled. And you're like, oh my God, what's about to happen? Suddenly a fucking anvil drops on his head. And you just hear the do-do-do-do-do-do-do. And it's Peter Parker.
Spider-Ham, right? Is that what he's called?
Spider-Ham. And doesn't the villain say, Scorpion, say something like, oh, what are you, some silly cartoon or whatever?
Yeah.
And then this is when he's like, you got a problem with cartoons?
He takes out a mallet, just dodges a piece of shit out of him.
So good. Like, I like how he's useful. He's not just a joke.
Oh, yeah. He's a badass at the same time. And he says, like, you know, how do you like cartoons now? Or whatever he says.
Afterwards, he starts sending everyone back home. Noir's like, I'm keeping this Rubik's Cube. Penny says bye with her little, like, spider. Mm-hmm. And Spider-Ham's like, that's all, folks.
Yeah, and then they're like, can he say that legally? They acknowledge that that's, like, probably a pretty delicate line to use.
Warner Brothers, right? Like, I mean, yeah. I mean, Warner Brothers will take you down.
We've come to fucking learn, right?
Jesus Christ.
I know, dude.
Oh, man.
I'm, like, so tempted to get into that, but let's not.
Yeah. If you're on the reaction channel, you know what's happening. But anyways, Gwen and Miles have that final goodbye. There's a little bit of tension there. Who knows what happens? We know, because Across the Spider-Verse happens.
Yeah.
But then there is this final, like, Peter B. Parker and Miles. And Peter B. Parker is like, all right, I'm staying behind and everything. He's like, what? No, you're not. He's like, just let me handle this, kid.
Yeah.
And Miles doesn't let him go.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, even because, like, the rationality that Peter had
Miles,
before...
Sorry. Miles lets him go.
Yeah.
Miles forces him to go.
Yeah, yeah. And Peter's rationality originally was because Miles couldn't stay behind to destroy it, so I'll do it. But even when Miles is there, Peter finds a way to kind of sabotage it and be like, no, I'll do it. Don't worry about it. And then Peter says, I can't let another Spider-Man die. Then Miles says, I can't either.
Yeah.
You know? He says, you got to go home.
You got to go home, man.
Yeah.
Oh, man. And then this is the other moment that I was talking about. Mm-hmm. This is the scene that, again, like, makes me, like, cry without a doubt. Like, I've been in a plane and teared up on this scene. He just, like, you got to go home. He's like, how will I know if everything will be okay? Right? He's like, you won't. It's a leap of faith. Yeah. And then he lets him go. And there's this brilliant shot of Peter Parker being like, not bad, kid.
Yeah, it's badass. Oh, it's so good.
So good. And it's like, it's, I think the reason why it makes me tear up is what I've been saying over and over again. Peter B. Parker is like the closest to our relationship with Spider-Man. And it felt like our childhood hero grew up and maybe got a little sad.
Yeah.
You know? And now it feels like our childhood hero's okay again. And
like he's ready to get back into the world and
He'll be okay.
Yeah, I mean, that's...
There's a personal relationship that I think you and I actually have with Spider-Man. And so seeing Peter B. Parker actually, like, turn out okay at the end and go back to his MJ is like, okay, thank God.
Yeah, I think it's just very universal, you know, that, like... That is life, isn't it? Like, we don't really know how things are going to turn out, but you really just have to try. And I think that's Miles' whole journey is trying to figure out what his place is, but he just has to try. As long as he's trying, he's succeeding, you know?
And sometimes a teacher has to be reminded of that, too.
Yeah.
And then there's this, like, final bravado interaction between Fisk and Miles, which is just, okay, first of all, it's really funny to me that Fisk is also there just, like, lifting cars.
Yeah, he's, like, super strong. He's, like, comic book strong.
And, you know, I will say his wife and his son, you know, that whole storyline, I respect that the movie was trying to give it some weight. I just don't think it, like, hits as hard as the movie thinks it does.
I think what it is, though, it has the same themes or echoes the same fear that Peter has, too, of, like, Fisk is in denial that he lost his family. Because his family died running away from him, right? They were leaving him.
Yeah.
And I think Fisk is in denial and has to have that control of his own destiny. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And I think he's trying to use the multiverse as a way to control it. When Peter, on the other hand... And Miles, you know, are both trying to move forward.
Yeah.
And you know what I'm saying? Like that Peter has to go back and rebuild his life and accept the reality that he lost MJ, but hopefully maybe he can get her back. You don't know for sure, in the first movie at least, you know? And it's about the fact that he just tried. And so I think that's what Fisk's, like, kind of his antithesis of Spider-Man is, thematically at least.
Yeah.
And I understand it doesn't spend as much time on it and he's not in the movie
as
much.
No, but I understand. I think what you're saying does definitely make sense. I think it's just meant as a device to echo the themes of the movie.
Yeah.
Fisk and Miles have this great final fight. His dad is there. Miles' dad is there just seeing him fight. And he's like, get up, Spider-Man.
Yeah.
Which is, again, bringing it back to the theme of the movie, which is Spider-Man always gets back up.
No matter how many times.
He gets back up. And another theme that we didn't really discuss is just, like, anyone can wear the mask.
Yeah, I was just thinking that, too. Like,
we didn't really talk about that, but yeah.
Yeah, that speech that Mary Jane gives at the very beginning after Chris Pine's Spider-Man dies.
Yeah.
How she says, like, how Spider-Man inspires all of us to be our best selves. And so in a way, it's our responsibility to carry on his legacy and do the best we can to be heroes. And they do a great job of tying that back as well when the movie finally ends, how you see that quote by Stan Lee. I forgot to write it down, but you know how he says, like...
I'm going to look it up.
Yeah, look it up. Look it up.
Hang on. Oh, yeah. So, okay. The quote, it's... Because remember, it was an image of Stan Lee's glasses.
Yeah.
Which really, yeah. I was like, oh, man, this movie gets it.
Bless and, that man.
The quote was, "That person who helps others simply because it should or must be done, and because it is the right thing to do, is indeed, without a doubt, a real superhero."
Well, yeah. How can that not, like, touch you in the heart a little bit? You know what I mean?
So. And I think, okay, also, Spider-Man is, like, that's a true, like, amazing Stan Lee invention. Now, there's a lot of stories out there that, like, Stan Lee wasn't the one that was creating all these characters. It was like, a dual production, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And also, I think Blank Check pointed this out when they were covering their Sam Raimi series. A lot of times, like, when Stan Lee talks about, like, his process, he'll become very basic. He'll be like, what you need is a great story.
Yeah.
Griffin from Blank Check pointed this out, to give him some credit. And he was saying how, like, Spider-Man's the one character that when Stan Lee talks about him, he has, like, this big speech about him. He understands him. And it's, like, this thing that is, like, the most personal to him in a way.
Spider-Man as a whole is very much a guy who didn't ask for these abilities, but he's choosing to do the right thing with them.
Yeah.
He's choosing to do good at his own expense pretty much the entire time. Every, you know, most Spider-Man stories you see, his life is a fucking mess. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
He's struggling with girl stuff. He's like dealing with the normal adulthood stuff, but it's a mess because he's choosing to go out and save lives.
Yeah.
And so I think, you know, it's relatable in its own way. It's kind of a metaphor for whatever it is, career burnout, however we want to look at it, you know? But there's always that thing that he's always sacrificing his own life and well-being and struggling with balance because he puts so much into helping people.
I think it's what makes Spider-Man so winning. It's why we love him. And I think the movie, like I said before, it's challenging all of that. It's addressing that. It's super meta in a way that's not annoying.
Yeah.
It's meta in a way of just like, there's been 7 Spider-Man movies, so we have to address that it's been done a lot, but we're still going to use that. And so speaking on that, remember when I was saying how like there's that line at the end of the Raimi Spider-Man where he's like, I have a dad. His name was Ben Parker.
Yeah.
And I was saying that there's a line similar to this at the end. That final fight with Fisk, he says, I'll always have my family. You ever hear the shoulder touch? And then he touches the shoulder. He's like, hey.
And then just yeets him all the way.
But that's his version of saying, I'll always have my family. Mm-hmm. I had my family and Uncle Aaron. He was like, he was also a dad to me. And it's like their version of that line, but in the most Miles way, which is just like, you ever heard the shoulder touch?
Yeah, it's his way of honoring that, like, everyone who's had an impact on his life and his direction and what he sees, you know, valuable.
The applause in my theater when he did that was like Captain America getting a hammer.
Yeah. just erupted.
Yeah, it's such a beautiful moment. And I mentioned this already earlier in the video when we were talking about the father-son story. There's that final phone conversation that they have, and he puts the mask on, hugs his dad. He's just like, thank you for your cooperation.
Yeah, he does this weird low voice.
Yeah, again, Shameik Moore does such a great job feeling like an actual kid. Like, he's so good.
Yeah, yeah.
And there's that brilliant shot of Wilson Fisk looking like a bat.
Yeah, where he has this big theatrical defeat where he's just there, webbed up.
And, you know, like, all the other Spider-Men in their own places. You see Peter B. Parker finally go into MJ, you know? And, like... he has that speech about like how anyone can wear the mask.
Well, and what's cool is like now it's his turn to do the, all right, let's start from the beginning, you know,
for the last 2 weeks.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. And he does his origin story. He's starting his story at least.
Yeah.
I'm honestly, it might be a perfect movie to me.
It's pretty masterfully structured. Like, yeah. I don't think there's a single flaw with it.
And it's just groundbreaking. I remember when Across the Spider-Verse was coming out, I was so excited for it, like many people were. And my expectations were so high that I left disappointed because I thought that the movie was trying to do way too much and it was very bloated to me. And I need to give it another chance because having expectations that high for any movie is unfair for the movie.
Yeah. I would love to talk about that one sometime. If people like this podcast and comment, if you wanted to want us to do the sequel,
totally
we will.
But I do really want to watch it again.
Yeah.
And I think, like, I just respect like Across the Spider-Verse for doing something so wildly different and for building upon the story of, like, was Miles truly meant to be Spider-Man? That's what, like, Across the Spider-Verse is truly about.
Yeah.
And it's just fucking awesome that, like, very talented and ambitious people came to make something so emotional and so personal and understanding of who this character that means so much to both of us.
And a character that's been done so many times, and to have such a fresh take on him is really, it's a really fucking impressive achievement.
I think we can wrap it up there.
Yeah.
I think that's pretty good. Thank you guys for watching. Thank you guys for listening. This is a really exciting new format in terms of, like, how it looks and how it sounds, you know? So I think Spider-Verse, you know, the way Spider-Verse broke the genre of animated filmmaking, we're right now breaking the genre of video podcasting.
You know what's funny is, like, the humor that you're doing is very visual right now. You know, you're putting a lot of faces, but, like, audio listeners are just thinking, who the fuck is this guy saying? Like, it doesn't sound like a joke audibly.
Yeah, someone just skipped the podcast just now.
Yeah, they're like, oh, I listened to all that for nothing. What a pretentious douche.
All right, well, thank you guys so much. Thank you to our patrons for supporting us again. We really appreciate it. And as always, stay nice, dudes.